Hey guys, my name is Del Baker. I'm an alcoholic. And I'm going to need some tissue up here, Richards. I'm a crier, so get used to that. I'm going to set my timer here. My promoter, Marie, where is she? My promoter said this is an hour and a half, so now I found out it's just an hour. Lucky you guys. So I'm going to shorten this up a little bit, but I want to set a timer. I want to make sure I get sober in time. Have some kind of message. Won't tell you who told me that, but he's sitting in the front row. All right, so what do we got here? We'll just do about 20 minutes. How's that? All right, so I told you who I am. I want to thank everybody who's been a service to this this convention this week, and thank you so much, and thank you for the opportunity to come here today and share my experience, strength, and hope. And I want to thank my amazing wife, before I forget, for her support and in everything that I do, and is truly thank you, Brenda. Brenda knows I need it. Yeah, and I'll give you an example of that support that I get. Last weekend, we went on a trip through the desert, and we went through Salton Sea and Joshua Tree and up through Death Valley. And I said to her, we were leaving on Thursday, and I said to her on Wednesday, I said, I have a perfect excuse not to go to the Wednesday night men's meeting because I'm getting ready for the trip, you know. But I said to her, I said, you know, I don't know if we're going to be able to find a meeting out there in the middle of the desert or not, so maybe I should go. And she, without hesitation, she said, yes, you should. I said, but I'm not all packed, right, just go. So that's the kind of support I get. She's really a doll. If you guys don't know her, I hope you meet her someday. You know, I noticed that during these meetings, I noticed yesterday when Sam spoke, thank you, Sam, for speaking. That was awesome. I noticed that they don't ask for newcomers during in the beginning. And so I want to ask if anybody who's less than 90 days of sobriety, raise your hand. All right. Yeah, I mean, I just find this thing is so much about identifying. You know, all through my sobriety, it's about been identifying. And when I couldn't stay here, it's because I couldn't identify. I didn't want to be an alcoholic. I didn't want to have this terrible thing that today has turned out to be so wonderful. Somebody said something one time to the effect of, you know, when I got sober, I'd lost everything. And somebody later said, you know, I found out that the everything I lost turned out to be nothing, and the nothing that I was left with turned out to be everything. And that's been my experience. I mean, what a great theme this weekend of gratitude, the attitude of gratitude. I mean, I'm walking around here last night and running into people that I haven't seen in years, and I'll tell you guys about it. I mean, it's a long time being able to stay here. So I've been to thousands of meetings in North County, South County, at the beach, East County, and just all over the place. And so some of those people, I'm running into them last night, and you know, we're talking about you know, just catching up a little bit, And then this one guy, John, is here tonight, John P., he says, man, I was a mess 20 years ago. He says, I had nothing going on. I was going nowhere. I thought, what a gift it is today to have some kind of future. You know, what an amazing life that he and I both shared. At the same moment, we just realized that we weren't supposed to make it this long. Neither one of us planned on living past 30. Yeah, I'm 60 years old, still walking around. It's only because of Alcoholics Anonymous. I have it that God brought me to Alcoholics Anonymous, and Alcoholics Anonymous took me back to God. Because I didn't want to have anything to do with God when I got here. So, in order to get here, you had to do a little drinking, and I did do my share. I didn't get here because I had a couple of bad weekends. I had a couple of bad decades. I'm sorry if Adam T's in the group because I stole a lot of his stuff. I know he's one of the speakers. This weekend, I asked Marie, I said, who all is speaking this weekend? And so she goes, why? And I said, I just want to know who I might be sitting with. And she says, you're so vain. And, And then she tells me the lineup, and I said, uh-oh, Adam T. And she goes, what's wrong? Do you not like him? I said, no, I stole half of his shit. But he doesn't speak till Sunday, so I'm going to go ahead and use it now. And you guys are at the spiritual breakfast. You just hear it again. But I didn't have a couple bad weekends. I had a couple bad decades. And it started off real slow. And I started drinking just to try to get friends. I was a loner. Matter of fact, from a child, I felt different, separate, and alone. Anybody relate to that? Just always felt different. I worked at a place that sold beer when I was 17, 18 years old, and I found that I could get friends by giving away free beer. And that's how I started. And I really didn't like the taste of it, didn't like the way it made me feel, but it did make me feel like I had friends. And it just progressed from there. I had no idea I had some kind of allergy to alcohol, that I would start waking up in handcuffs. And that's the way it happened. And it was very progressive. And I hear people say, in the circles that we run in, that my worst day sober is better than my best day drinking. And I think, man, you got screwed. Because I had a great time for a long time. It was progressive. It just started off with having fun and, you know, no consequences. And then it got to having fun with a little consequences. And then it was like 50-50. I didn't really know what I was going to get. And pretty soon it was mostly consequences and very little fun. And then towards the end, it was just me and my hot plastic bottle of vodka. Sitting on top of the hills around San Diego, just all by myself, calling into work, on Tuesday. And I haven't been to work yet. And just, you know, Wednesday's going to be my first day of work of the week. And just start losing one job after another. And so, so somewhere along the line, though, I met a different amazing woman who married me. And Angelica knows her. In fact, she invited her to our wedding. We had a little girl, and she already had a son, so I had a built-in family. And so in my mid-20s, late 20s, we had this child, and that marriage lasted about 3 years. And she just couldn't do it any longer. She said, you know, I don't want our kids to think that this is what a father looks like. You know, this is the way. You don't come home any night of the week before like 10 o'clock. Come home every night drunk, booze on your breath. And she says, I just can't do it anymore. And so she left with the kids. And I would see the kids every other weekend and every Wednesday. And that went on for a while. And of course, when she leaves, it's just like when I get out of jail or get out of a recovery home or a detox. Soon as something like that happens, it's on. You know, it's like that's what was holding me back from really drinking the way I wanted to drink. I didn't know that, but the record reflects that. It's like that's when it really happens. And I'm a late stage alcoholic. Towards the end, I'm good for 2/5 a day. I drink 2 hours, sleep 2 hours, drink 2 hours, sleep 2 hours. If I go 6 hours without a drink, I have a seizure. And some of you guys sitting in the room have seen that. And it's just where alcohol took me. I mean, I go to meetings up in La Jolla with some people that almost spilt their glass of wine. And, oh, I've got a problem. And they come to AA. And they've been sober ever since. It's just not my story. And I don't know that me drinking 2/5 a day and going in and out of AA for so long makes me any more of an alcoholic than them. I really don't, because I know the way they think. But it's just two different versions. They were willing to surrender quicker than I was. I wasn't willing to surrender. And I had so much programming from childhood that nothing will ever control you. And, you know, those were things that my parents told me, and I stuck with that. It's like, no, I got this. And, you know, I just kept holding on to every little bit of my drinking and my being in control of life. And it just wasn't working. And, you know, my cycle is that in 1999, I started, I'll tell you, my sobriety date is April 29th, 2010. And For those of you who, well, those of you who know me know that it's a miracle, especially those of you who know me before I got here, and I'll tell you a little bit more about that, but my cycle is I put myself in a recovery home when I woke up one morning and I realized that the shaking is not even stopping with drinking, and I can't go to work anymore, and I've been losing relationships, losing jobs, but it's just too long. And I called this girl that I knew was an Alcoholics Anonymous or had been to Alcoholics Anonymous, and I said, I'm in trouble here. I don't know what to do. She said, you need to go to AA. And I said, okay. So I went to a little meeting down in El Cajon Coffee Clutchers, and that was my first meeting in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I related to the stuff that was, we don't have the steps up here, do we? I related to the people and what they were saying, because you guys are also wrecking cars, wrecking relationships, you know, losing jobs, you know, all these types of things. Not to the magnitude that I was, it didn't feel like. But that was happening for you guys also. But you said your solution was these 12 steps that were behind you on the wall. And I'm looking at that and going, I just can't see how that's going to work for me. And there's got to be more to this than you know, just that stuff there. Besides, it said God in there. And I knew right, this is one of those church deals. This is like a cult or something. You guys are all on the, you know, you're probably selling newspapers on Sunday on the corner or something, you know, I'm going to shove God down my throat. And, but I did relate, and I saw people there that I felt like, that, so some of them have been to prison and in jail, and I said, okay, well, maybe these are my people. I felt like I belonged there. I kept coming back, but I couldn't stay. And the reason was is that you know, there's three legacies of recovery, and it's of Alcoholics Anonymous, and it's unity, recovery, and service. So I could do the unity. I could hang out with you guys. I really didn't like to. It was really uncomfortable because I don't know how to act when I'm sober. But I could even go out to eat with you, maybe. I could do service. I could set up chairs. I could make coffee. I could empty butt cans. I could do stuff like that. But the recovery part is what you guys said, oh, that's the 12 steps. And I'm going, that says God. So what I did is I would fake it. And I'd try to do it buffet style. The ones that didn't say God in them, or even higher power, because higher power, I knew what you were talking about when you say higher power. Yeah, you're not fooling me. And so I was just going to do those ones, and I couldn't stay. I kept getting drunk, and pretty soon, and I'm a violent drunk, to be honest with you. I do things like I ram my car into you on the road. If I don't, you know, you make some bad move, I don't agree with it, so I hit you with my car. Shove you off the road. To be truthfully honest, I unloaded a gun into a car next to me one time. And sometimes I get caught. So, you know, pretty soon I'm going to jail. I'm going to jail for battery. I shove people in the median, and then I pull them out of the car and I start hitting them. Unfortunately, sometimes that little girl who's like 3 or 4 years old is in the front seat watching me do that. And she's looking at me with these big, huge eyes. I can remember vividly walking back to towards the car after I've done something out here, held a gun to somebody's head or beat somebody up, and walking back and seeing her standing in the front seat with these big, huge eyes watching this. And that's the type of stuff I do, and I start going to jail. And I get out of jail. I got a really good attorney, and I decided to start putting myself in recovery homes. And so I go into recovery homes, and it's the same type of deal. As I can't stay in there. I can't stay sober longer than about 2 months. And even though I'm in there and it's controlled, and I'm being told when to eat, when to drink, you know, when to go to meetings, when to go to the bathroom, you know, everything, it's pretty controlled. Eventually, they let me get out and go get a job. And I don't know if you guys have stayed in those types of recovery homes where you're there during the you're there at nighttime, but during the day you go out and get a job. And I'm going out working during the day. I have to be back home by a certain time. Dinner's going to be cooked, and somebody's going to come in, have a meeting, type of thing. And I'm going to this piddly job. Oh, and there's somebody who's come in on an H&I panel, like these guys, and they're sitting up front, and I'm listening to what Mark has to say, and I really like Mark. So I said, Mark, you know, will you sponsor me? And I know that's going to make good points with the recovery home. So so Mark starts showing up once a week. We sit out in the parking lot, and we're reading the book together. And Mark is asking me, Dale, how's your prayer? I go, oh, it's good. So you're praying every day. Oh, dude, feeling it. And you know, we're good actors. And I'm just, you know, I'm lying to him. And I think Mark doesn't know, by the way. So, yeah, if you're lying, we know. You know, and I'm thinking it. And the problem is that inside, once again, I'm not identifying. Inside, it's just eating me up because I have a secret. And I know whenever I have a secret, I'm in trouble. And so I got the secret, but I'm sticking with the plan. I want to stay sober. Every time I'm in a recovery home, every time I'm in jail, I want to be sober. I really do. I just can't stay sober. I know now it's because I wasn't willing to have a God, but at the time I was like, I'm really trying, but I got this lie, and I just I'm lonely in a room full of people, and lonesome and boredom, those two things will get me every time. And I'll go and drink again. So I'm going to this little job every day out of this recovery home, and I'm passing by the liquor store, and eventually I'm making a plan. It's all I want is really just one 12-ounce Budweiser. That's all I want, just some kind of relief. And so sure enough, I will make a plan. My mind will make a plan. So on the weekend, I'm making a plan. Come Monday, I pull into that liquor store on the way back from work, on the way back to that recovery home, and I get one 12-ounce Budweiser, and I sit out in the car, and I drink that, and it feels so good, and immediately the guilt sets in. But I'm alcoholic, so I'm sticking with the plan, because that's what we do. So I slide into that recovery home, and the smell of food is in the air, and it works brilliantly. It's just like nobody suspects a thing. Slide right in, eat dinner, and I'm just doing it this one day, you know, so that's perfect. So the next day I go to work, and guess what? Yeah, the car just automatically pulls in there. And it's, you know, it's two tall boys and one of those little airplane bottles of black velvet. By the way, I'm a classy drinker. I drink vodka out of a plastic bottle, you know, Kamchatka, Taka, whatever's cheapest, you know, that I can get, and black velvet. So I drink a fifth of vodka all morning long and a fifth of black velvet in the evening. That's my daily thing when I'm out there running and gunning. So I slide back into that recovery home, and nobody smells anything. And then it's Wednesday. So I go in, and there's two tall boys. And it's really stupid to buy a half pint, isn't it? I mean, for the value. So what you do, logically, if you're a numbers person like I am, just get a pint, but only drink half of it. Follow me? So it's the two tall boys. Unfortunately, I don't have an off switch, and I finished the whole pint. Now I slide into that recovery home and say, I smell alcohol. Somebody says, you didn't smell anything. And guess what? I'm kicked out of that recovery home. And then what happens? It's on. It's on now. Within 3 days, I'm back to my two-fifths a day. Within 3 days. And so then the cycle goes again. And it goes until I'm asleep at the wheel and ran into somebody and then take off and somebody gets my license plate number. It's another hit and run. Or I beat somebody up and somebody gets my license number and I'm back in jail again. Or I turn myself into another, go into another hospital, another detox, put myself in there again. It's just the cycle just goes on and on and on. I'm just so tired of it. At the age of 13, my daughter says to my ex-wife, she says, I don't want to see that man anymore. She didn't say, I don't want to see my dad. She said, I don't want to go with that man anymore on weekends or every other week on Wednesdays. I don't want to see him anymore. You know, she's tired of the lies. She's tired of me, you know, I got a flat tire, or I had to stay at work, you know, I don't even have a job. She's tired of the, you know, stuff. Kids are, kids are very intuitive, and she knows what's going on, and she's done. She don't have anything to do with me, and it would be another 5 years before I get sober. And so the truth is that this cycle just keeps going and going and going, and I get lower and lower and lower, and eventually I'm staying on a guy's couch down in Ocean Beach, and what I do is every day he gets up and goes to work, and I just go down to the volleyball courts there at Dog Beach, and I just watch people play volleyball because I used to play volleyball. And I sit there, and I'm awake for 2 hours drinking and crying and thinking about what a failure I am. And then I pass out, and I'm asleep for a couple hours. And where are you going, David? Thank you for your service. Oh, time to get sober. killing it. Where was I? Volleyball. Sitting in the parking lot. So I'm sitting in the parking lot, getting sober. So I'm sitting in the parking lot, and at this point, I have been at least 10 years. I'm going in and out of AA, in and out of AA, and I just want to die. I know if I'm in a room this big, I can't be the only person that's contemplated taking their life. And I just don't want to live anymore. I just keep trying this and keep trying this. And I'm tired of going to jail. And I'm tired of another detox. And I'm tired of another recovery home and another sober living. And I just can't take it anymore. I just want out. I just can't do it. And for whatever reason, this just one day I drove myself to another hospital and you know, if you go into a hospital with alcoholism they really is all they do. If you don't have insurance, they just make sure you don't die on their watch. They pump you full of fluids and then shoot you out the door. And I come out the door into the parking lot, and here's a guy who's let me stay on his couch. He says, so now what are you going to do? And I said, Mike, how do you even know that I'm here? And he says, it doesn't matter how I know that you're here. It matters that they told me that your blood alcohol level is 0.47. And that early death was imminent. And that I'm probably going to find you dead on my couch. And I don't want to find you dead on my couch. And for me, it was a really important day because I was out of options at that point. Now, and I had made some secret agreement with myself that if I ever have to live outside, I'd kill myself. Like, that's the last straw. I'm not living outside. So I said, I'm going to go to another hospital, and that's what I'm going to do. And I left. I just went right back down to the beach, and I'm sitting there at the beach, and I'm thinking, today's the day. I know what I'm going to do. I'm going to drive my truck off this big, huge bridge, but there's no way that I can live. And I turn the key and I look at the gas tank, and I got a half a tank of gas, and I lift up my bottle of my fifth of Black Velvet, and I said, I had a half a fifth, and I said, I can make it there. I don't know, for some reason, I looked through the windshield, and I said, you know, if there's a God out there like they're talking about in Alcoholics Anonymous, then show me something. And there was no bright light, and the truck didn't shake. But it just came over me, and I know what came over me is this guy's voice from Lima Grove Alano Club, where I literally got sober 40 or 50 times. There's people in the audience here that witnessed that. kept dragging my ass back in there, and this guy had said this. He said, you know, Dale, next time you're out there running and gunning, don't tell people that AA doesn't work, because you never did it. And the guy had me. I mean, he had me. And I knew at this point what I had been doing. I had been faking it for 11 years, and so I went to my last detox somewhere around April 26th, April 27th, I don't know, I'm pretty sure I finished that bottle, I don't know, I idle at about a 0.3 anyway, so 0.47 wasn't really that big of a deal, but I used April 29th just because I know it's a safe date. I was sober by then. I'd probably been there a day or two in that last detox, and this last detox I stayed the whole time. And some guy came in on an H&I panel, And is Jeremy from Pacific Beach. If you do beach recovery in PB, you know Jeremy. And Jeremy, man, he just can't quit moving, and he's all over the place, and he's talking, and he goes, we meet every day down in Pacific Beach. Come and join us. And it was the first time, first of all, it was the first time I ever stayed at the detox the whole 15 days. I was always that guy, you know, 2 days, forget this, give me my Valium, I'm out of here. Because I have to medically detox at this point. When you drink that volume of alcohol, or you will die. And so he says, we meet every day. And I did something that I'd done many times before, and that is that I wrote down on a piece of paper, okay, 3 meetings a day, 7 days a week. So I'm gonna go to Monday night. I'm gonna go to down to the men's meeting down at South Bay Pioneers. I know that's a good one. I'm gonna go there. Every morning I'm going to go to that God's Garage, and on Sunday I'm going to go to North Shore's Alano Club. And then Wednesday night I'm going to go to Midweek Men's. I like that meeting. And I wrote down 3 meetings that, and I had done this several times before. The difference was this time when I got out of that detox, that's what I went and did. I didn't go to a recovery home. Don't get me wrong, I have nothing against recovery homes. I've lived in a lot of them. It's just ultimately you're going to end up in AA if you're going to do this thing. And I'd known that after all this time, so I just went to AA, and I was all in this last time. I've been all in ever since. By the time I finally surrendered that last time, I had lived in 6 recovery homes, 2 psych wards, 10 detoxes in every jail in San Diego County, and some in Utah, Colorado, and Nevada. My friend RJ was just saying, hey, we bought a house over in St. George. I go, hey, I was locked up there for a week. Tell the sheriff I said hi. Tell him I'm speaking at 3 o'clock on Friday. But that's just what it took, you know. And I went to that first meeting, and I didn't know anybody there except for this guy in tow with me who he and I both got out of detox the same day. And we went there, and I don't know what was said during that meeting, and only Jeremy was the only guy I knew, and Jeremy came up and gave me a big hug. And I was used to hugs at that point, and it felt good. And afterwards, I was smoking then. I'm outside and having a cigarette with my people, and this guy walks up to my buddy and says, "Hey, do you want to do this thing?" And my buddy says, "Do what?" And he says, "The 12 steps." And he goes, "No, I'm not ready for that." And I said, "I am." And I don't know if you ever said anything before that you'd like to like pull it back in. It's kind of how I felt right after that. But you know what? That guy saved my life. He goes, "Step around the corner." We stepped around the other side on Cass Street, and he says, "How's your God?" And I said, "You know, I got a problem with God." He goes, "Never mind, I can't work with you." And I said, "Gee, you didn't even allow me to talk. Give me a minute here. I have a problem with God. Listen, if you can't pray, I can't work with you." And he was that cut and dry. He goes, "I don't care what you pray to. This doesn't have to be that childhood God." The childhood God was the only God that I can envision. The dude with the robe and the beard up in the sky. That's the only God I knew from childhood. And so he says, "You know, is the ocean stronger than you?" And I said, "Well, yeah. I mean, threw me down, messed up my back one time." He goes, "Well, then pray to the ocean." I said, "That's stupid." And then I remembered at one point there was a tree outside of the coffee clutchers meeting down in El Cajon that I used to go and touch that tree, and I felt like some kind of connection. But at this point, I'm willing. Another guy over there at Lemon Grove Lawn Club he said, "Dell," he says, "be all in for a hockey season. Be in for 6 months, and if it doesn't work, then go kill yourself. But do it and see if it doesn't change your life." And so I'm like, I'm all in. I'm going to do no matter what, even if I have to pray. So he says, "Start praying." And this guy didn't have a job either. Come to find out later, he was only 8 months sober, living in a motorhome over in Mission Bay. And he met with me every day, and we started doing step work. And it was about a month down the road. He goes, "How's your praying?" I said, "Perfect." And he goes, "You still praying?" I said, "Yep, and I don't feel nothing. I'm only doing it because you said so. It's all mechanical, but I pray every morning and every night just like you said." And he said, "Well, just keep doing that." I started going to work at about a month and a half sober. And I remember talking to him one day, and I said, "You know, it feels like I'm starting to like figure stuff out." He goes, "What do you mean?" I said, "Like I figure things out like it doesn't seem like it's coming from me." And like about what? And I said, like work, her, the car, the apartment. I mean, I feel maybe this is like the alcohol finally being all the way out. Is that pause thing, that post-acute withdrawal symptoms is finally working? I'm very educated at this point. And he says, are you still praying? And I said, yeah. And I said, by the way, since you brought that up, I tend to drive, I'm a competitive driver. I still can be a little bit today. I was really a competitive driver when I first got sober. And I drive to work, and I'm darting in and out of traffic, and if somebody cuts me off, you know, or gets one up on me, I'm not mad at them. I'm just like, yeah, right on. And I talk to this empty seat beside of me. And I'm talking to this empty seat, and I'm going, did you see that? Watch this. And I drive in, and I said to this sponsor of mine, I said, is it okay if my God is an invisible NASCAR driver? And he said, perfect. And I'll tell you this, for the first year and a half of my sobriety, my God was an invisible NASCAR driver. And it worked for me. It worked. It was something. See, I needed to have the actions. Didn't matter what I thought. All of you guys have heard people say, you know, there's no chapter into thinking, but there is one into action. So, I mean, I needed to be into action. And he right away got me into service. I remember I was just at that meeting for a few days, at that morning meeting, and it was a young people's meeting back then at God's Garage, and full of young people. I'm 47 years old. I'm in there, and this guy comes up and he says, hey, after the meeting, we're going to pick up the chairs and mop the room. And by him saying we, he meant me. And so do that, and then empty the trash in the restroom. And it goes across the street at the church building, across the street, over the dumpsters over there. And I'm thinking, really? I don't want to curse too bad, but are you fucking kidding me? I didn't say that, but that's what I was thinking. After the meeting, I picked up the chairs, I mopped the floor, I want to have a cigarette really bad. And I'm watching everybody smoking, all these young kids. The guy I got out of detox with is already back drinking again. And so I do all that, and I leave. I'm pissed off all the way back home. And the next day I come to the meeting, and this guy walks up to me, not the same guy, different guy walks up to me. He goes, hey, you're Dell, right? I was like, yeah. And he said, thanks for stacking the chairs yesterday and mopping the floor. It really needed it. I can tell you, can't tell you how important that was for me. See, nobody had ever thanked me for doing anything in a long, long time. See, I didn't do anything for a long, long time that was worthy of a thank you. I got addicted to service at that point. I wanted to mop the floor every day. They go, no, no, we only do that like once a month. You just happen to be the newcomer at the time. I was like, okay. But a guy, that same guy who came in on my H&I panel at about 6 weeks over, he said to me, he goes, hey, do you want to go back into McAllister Detox? I go, I can go back in there as a guest? He goes, no, you're the main speaker. Which I didn't know they didn't have main speakers. But I said, what do you mean? I said, what do I have to share at 6 weeks sober? He goes, dude, you have more sobriety than anybody in that room except for me. They will relate more to you at 6 weeks sober than they're going to relate to me at 10 years sober. And I know that today. I've had a commitment at McAllister Institute for 13 years now. Blaine over there can contest to that. I mean, I love it. I started in there talking to the jailbirds because I'm a jailbird. They have a program there called New Connections. It's guys that are on their way into prison. Maybe they've had a dirtier analysis, and their probation officer says, you know, I'm not going to throw you back into prison right away. But go here, live here for up to 90 days, and we'll see how you do, how you can act out in public. Because they go on day passes, come back here and stay here at night. Or guys that they wanted to let out of prison, but they don't really trust them yet out on the streets, they let them out early, they said, but go stay over here. So I did that for a couple of years. You know, the front five people, there's a room of 40 guys, men only, and they're hard, you know, And the first five guys in the front rows are paying attention, kinda, and the other 35 are just screwing off. And then while I'm doing that, people are saying, hey, you want to go into this detox with me over here and go into this detox over here? And I'm going to detox, and I found out that my passion is detox. I love going to the detoxes. I love going in there. It just takes me back. I love when people are at that place where they're ready to change their life. I mean, I did it so many times. I relate to it so much. That first year of recovery was crazy. I tell you, it was crazy. I was working a second shift job. I'm sleeping 4 hours a night and in two different increments, only 2 hours at a time. And I'm going to 16 meetings a week, and I'm doing meetings like crazy. I got H&I commitments, and I'm working about 75 hours a week. So there's why I can't sleep, right? I don't have time to sleep. I'm just doing so much, and I'm building bicycles like crazy. Got bicycles hanging in the garage. I'm building cars that are all up and down the street. My poor neighbors. I live two blocks off the water in Pacific Beach, and I've taken up 8 parking spots. They hated me. And I'm building these bicycles like crazy, and I'm still trying to fill this hole that's inside of me, this God-sized hole that's inside of me with stuff, right? It's like, I got to make money. I got to prepare for retirement. I got to build something so you'll look at me and appreciate me. Oh, he's got cars, you know, or whatever it is. And trying to do whatever I can do to impress you, impress me. I don't know who I'm trying to impress, but I'm just building stuff, you know. And at one point, some guys come over after the meeting, after Dawn Patrol. My apartment was, you could throw a baseball and hit my apartment from Dawn Patrol at this point. And I lived there for 8 years. Like, I need to be next to an AA meeting. And they came over and they looked in the garage and go, man, you got a lot of bicycles here. You got 1, 2, 3. You have 8 bicycles. I go, yeah, well, you know, I mean, I got a couple beach cruisers, a couple road bikes, a couple mountain bikes, you know, a little bit of everything. And they said, but we don't see you ride them. And I said, well, I don't ride them. And you know, it didn't occur to me that maybe that was alcoholic. Now we're down to two bicycles we don't ride, right? So, progress. So that's what that looked like. But, you know, things started happening for me. And really, it seemed like every 2 years, something, there was like another milestone, if you will. And that was, I think I got to fix my teeth first. I got to expunge my complete criminal record at some point. I think maybe it was about 6 years sober. I expunged my complete criminal record. I got to fix my credit. My sponsor said, too, he said, I'm thinking about going bankrupt and doing Chapter 13. And he goes, oh, no, you're going to pay those people back. And so pro tip here, if you're going to kill yourself, no reason to have good credit. So I maxed out my credit cards, I owed everybody. And he goes, oh, no, you're paying them back. And I said, yeah, you haven't heard about Chapter 13? And he says, no, you need it. And looking back, I did. I needed to pay those people back. It wasn't about the money. It was about the surrender. It's like, I need to surrender. I'm trying to run my show my whole life. I don't want to admit that I can't do it myself, that I need you. It's just not in me. So it's this huge transformation that has to happen. My credit, my teeth. Finally entered the real estate market at about, 8 or 9 years sober and bought a home. I mean, how does a gutter drunk like me do that? I mean, it's got to be Alcoholics Anonymous. That little girl, that 13-year-old little girl, she's 31 now. Most Fridays I play volleyball with her at Golden Hill Rec Center. She loves me more than I love myself. She forgives me more than I can forgive myself. See, all she wanted back was her dad. That's all she wanted. I have a few minutes left. I'm going to tell you a couple stories. One of them, you old-timers already know it. So this is a story about this guy who's at home working in his home office. And he's got a 10-year-old son. That's the way I heard it. And And his son wants to keep throwing, he wants to throw the football, and he keeps going in and going, "Dad, Dad, let's throw the football." And the dad says, 15 more minutes, give me 15 more minutes. And the kid comes back 15 minutes later, and the dad needs more time, 15 more minutes. And eventually, after so many times, the dad says, look, he turns around, he grabs this big puzzle off of the shelf in his office, and he hands him this puzzle, and it's a puzzle of the world. And the thing's like 36 by 36. And he tells the kid, he says, go build that puzzle. He's thinking, that'll keep him busy. Go build that puzzle, and when you're done with that, I'll throw the football with you, guaranteed. The kid comes back like 20 minutes later with a piece of cardboard, and he's built the puzzle. And the dad is like, what happened? Like, how did you do that? And the kid says, well, Dad, is on the other side, it was a man, and once I put the man together, the whole world just fell into place. That's exactly what happened for me in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I didn't do it alone. This room is full of people that were there listening to me every week about what was going on in my life. Whether it be her, the job, the car, my sobriety, some other asshole in the room that pissed me off. You know, whatever it is, listening to that and walking me through and telling me how they do life today, how they surrender. Angelica and I both laugh now because we both say to each other, you might be right. I learned that from you guys. When she says something I disagree with, I tell her, you might be right. Now she's feeding it back to me. You might be right. Those people have walked me through all this time. The other story is, I'm going to tell you a story about Big Mike. And Big Mike, there's some of us in the room here tonight. We were down in Puerto Vallarta. About, I don't know, was right at COVID, so it was February 2020, and we were down in Puerto Vallarta. 570 of us alcoholics took over a resort down there, and had a week-long convention, and it was amazing. We had so much fun, riding boats, going into town, and just having meetings, and eating, and doing all this stuff. And one day we're coming up off the beach, and. And we're probably a group of 8 or 10 of us, and I tend to be the ringleader, certainly when it comes to food. And it's like, okay, it's time to eat. We get off the boat. Let's all get up there, and let's figure out what restaurant we're going to go to. So we all get in. It's a really steep ramp coming up off the beach in this concrete, and all the sand from your feet, it's real slippery. So we're helping each other get up to the top. We get up to the top, and Mike is not here, but Mike, it's one of my mentors in the program. Mike goes back down the ramp, and I'm thinking, where's he going? He must have left something in the boat. I don't know. And he's down there for a while, and pretty soon here comes Mike, and he's got some stranger on his arm, some woman he's like bringing up the ramp. And I thought, well, that was nice, but who's she? She's probably with us. She's alcoholic, you know. And he gets her up to the top. He turns around and goes back down. Well, where is he going? He comes back up. He has another stranger. And I'm still thinking, you know, we're trying to figure out where we're going to eat. What are you doing? And because that's how I am at, you know, whatever that is, 13 years sober, 10 years sober, you know. And I only was like the third or fourth person he brought up the ramp before I realized this is what I'm supposed to be doing. I'm supposed to be going down there with Mike and helping every person up that ramp who needs help coming up the ramp. It just doesn't come, it's just not my natural instinct. That's why I need you guys. That's why I need your example. You show me how you live life, what you do when you're faced with opposition, when you're faced with you. The little boy in me can still be very angry and very mean. But with your example, I'm not that way. I'm going to end with a poem, and it's going to talk about, I relate to it as my relationship with you guys and with God and how I see God through you guys. How you guys bring me closer to God. And it goes like this. Because I sought my God, I could not see. I sought my soul, it eluded me. But I sought my brother, and I found all three. Thank you, guys.